Beyond the Mic with Sean Dillon.
We're joined on the Starline by an author, lawyer, New York Times bestseller, and 2023 Fuller Award winner for Lifetime Achievement. He's written more than a dozen books, including Suspect and Presumed Innocent. He returns to answer an important question in Presumed Guilty. We welcome back our friend, Scott Turow.
Hey, Sean. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely great, Scott. Let's go beyond the mic. You've practiced law. Can there be true justice for those who are presumed guilty?
I think that one of the things I was after in this book with the title is for readers to understand how steep the mountain is that criminal defendants have to climb if they're going to find a way out of the courtroom and their dilemma. And in the case of Aaron Housley, who's the defendant, presumed guilty, what is stacked against him is, first of all, most American juries know that the vast majority of defendants are guilty. So you can tell them as a judge whatever you want about the presumption of innocence. The truth is they look across the courtroom and think to themselves, she or he probably did it. So you start there. And then in Aaron's case, his girlfriend, who's now dead, was the daughter of one of the most prominent families in the state. And they have brought the considerable power that they wield, to bear against it. And last, Aaron, although he's been raised by white parents who adopted him, he is, by birth, at least part African-American. As Americans do things, he's recognized as Black. And that, too, comes with all kinds of assumptions about guilt. So is there justice for those who are presumed guilty? I guess occasionally. But it's, as I said before, it's a very steep hill to climb for most criminal defendants.
Your character, Rusty Savage, is back one more time, trying to enjoy retirement when all hell breaks loose. How do you relate to Rusty?
That's a great question, and something that, I didn't think about while I was writing, but of course, now that it's the aftermath and I have to talk about the book, I think about it a lot. And the question I ask myself, Sean, is how much of Rusty is me? And the answer is quite a bit, to tell you the truth. Presumed Innocent was, ironically, not the first novel I wrote. I wrote, I think, four others that went unpublished. But it was the first time that I really felt, the air under my wings. And part of it was the voice of Rusty Savage and the sensibility, which I'm quick to admit, in many ways matched my own. And is Rusty a large part of me? Yes. He is. Are there differences? Yes, of course. We've certainly shared certain experiences, like having been prosecutors. And there's experiences we haven't shared. Rusty has been in prison, for example, and I'm fortunate that nothing happened to me in my life that compelled that result. So he's me, but he's not me. And that's something that every author will tell you about virtually every character she or he writes about.
What's one thing about Rusty that makes him such a unique character? And was there one thing you almost decided to do to him, but then said, nah, he's had enough?
I've been writing now for 40 years. And I'm always credited with being, the so-called father of the legal thriller. But when I look back at Presumed Innocent, I think part of what made Rusty so captivating was that he was one of the first heroes of crime fiction who didn't speak in the sort of hard-boiled manner of, Sam Spade or you know, the Dashiell Hammett characters. And there was, he was not hard boiled. He was, in point of fact, in some ways, a sensitive guy, even though he's caught up in this this justice system where people are on trial for doing the worst things imaginable. So, and I thought that that was one of the innovations of presumed innocence, and I thought it was one of the things that made the book appeal to such a wide audience, the fact that it wasn't just hard-boiled crime fiction.
Author Scott Turow joined us beyond the mic, and it's time for the Rocky Nate. Scott, you know what this is eight random questions. Answer with the first thing that comes to your mind. There is no pressure.
Yeah.
Every time we talk, it's the gray and cold of winter, which you dislike. What's the one place you love to vacation?
Do we love to vacation? Well, I'll tell you where Adrian and I have moved, which is Naples, Florida. And I hope I don't offend your viewers by saying that, or your listeners by saying that, I have learned in Naples, Florida, that I am a weather slut, and that if you give me 80 degrees and clear skies in the middle of winter, I'm a very happy guy. So I would say Naples and the beaches of Southwest Florida are the first answer to your question.
Was there a class in law school that you loved unconditionally?
I loved the class, and I've always loved to read. I didn't like the analysis of literature that I was taught from grade school through graduate school, which operates on an assumption that authors have a degree of intentionality about what they're putting on the page, that I just don't buy. And very often, I think what you're writing about are things that seem to you as the author actually ambiguous. And, you know, it always seemed like the English teachers wanted, you know, very clear answers to those questions. But, you know, being asked to read great books in school, yeah, I love that part.
One of my favorite quotes of yours is, quote, "If life's lessons could be reduced to single sentences, there would be no need for fiction," unquote. So what's the one life lesson that was the hardest for you to learn?
I would give you two. One may be a corollary of the other. First, there is no such thing as a free lunch. The benefits in life, enjoyable things, do not come free. And, there usually is quite a bit of hard work before you get to the point of enjoying yourself. And the second, and as I said, it may be a corollary of the first thing I said, is that even when life is good, it's not easy. I have what I regard as a really blessed life. I live with a woman I love. I've been successful in a couple different careers. I'm get up most days quite content. And yet, I'm as crazy as everybody else. I get anxious, I get conflicted, I get angry. I always have to bear in mind that's life, man. It's not always going to be easy.
Amen to that. What's the one chore that Adrian depends on you to do?
The one chore that Adrian expects me to do: put away the dishes.
Scott, what's the name of the teacher that would be proud of you the most for becoming a writer?
Well, I will name two. One would be my second grade teacher, Mrs. Rubenstein, and the fourth grade teacher, Ms. Scher, who I thought she was just the toughest thing I'd met. You know, drill sergeants had nothing on her. And yet, her rigorous insistence on making sure that I particularly wrote clearly served me so well to come.
Do you remember the first book you checked out of a library?
No, because my mom was a great library goer. She'd been a grade school teacher in the Chicago Public Schools. So I'm sure that, she had me at the library from the time I was 5 or 6 years old. So you know, I could guess. I remember treasuring Black Beauty, I'm not sure that was the first, Sean.
Who are the three best writers right now?
Oh, boy. Three best writers right now. Number one, Ian McEwan, the great English novelist. Number two, I really have to give the nod to my friend Ann Patchett, who I think has written a remarkably consistent group of novels, and with her, Louise Erdrich, who's you know, another great novelist who's, you know, I just admire writers who are consistently good. And those three, you know, fall into that category as far as I'm concerned.
How about your favorite bookstore of all time?
My favorite bookstore of all time is probably in Winnetka, Illinois, a place called The Bookstall. That was the first bookstore as a grown-up that, you know, I was able to wander around in and really enjoy the potential of a bookstore. It's like a lot of great independent stores. It has a remarkably helpful staff who know the books on their shelves.
Let's sneak in a couple more with author of Presumed Guilty, Scott Turoby, on the mic. Jake Gyllenhaal has done an amazing job playing Rusty for Presumed Innocent on Apple TV+. When you saw the first episode, what emotions went through you?
Well, you know, Adrian and I had set, and so we saw what was happening. But I have learned over the years that it's sometimes very hard to predict how the individual scenes are going to get glued together. And, you know, I knew that David E. Kelly had written a great pilot script. So I wasn't surprised that the first episode was as amazing as it is. But it was still a thrill to see how it all came together. Because like I said, sometimes things fall apart.
Do you think your pilot pleading guilty could have made it today with all the success you've had with Presumed Innocent?
You know, woulda, coulda, shoulda, who knows? You know, who knows? Presumed Guilty has been optioned again by David E. Kelly and Bad Robot, J.J. Abrams' company, and Warner Brothers. So, you know, do I have great hopes for the success of this book when it's turned to celluloid? Yeah, I do. It's certainly a powerhouse team, so I'm optimistic about that.
Scott, when you go out on tour, meeting your fans, signing books, what does their fandom and their support mean to you?
A lot. You know, you sit as I sat, you know, on the morning commuter train 35 years ago, or in my basement where I finished the first draft of Presumed Innocent. It's an incredibly insular experience. And to have people stand in front of you, tell you how much they felt reading what you'd committed to paper, it's a thrill. It's, you know, it's like mission accomplished. To some extent, you feel it's apart from you, because my experience of Presumed Innocent is not exactly the same experience as readers had of that book. And I'm sure the same thing will be true with Presumed Guilty. I'm just grateful and I feel blessed that people want to stand in line and shake my hand, get my signature. It's very kind of them. So,
do you feel the law has changed for the better and or the worse the last 20 years, and how can it be fixed?
Well, one of the things I've learned along the road, Sean, is that the law is ever evolving. And there are things in the law that I think are better, and there are things that I think are worse. And you know, the contest that is always going on in the criminal law, which is where I, you know, what the area where I'm most familiar, there are two demands in that system. The first, and what I regard as the prominent, most prominent, is that every human being who comes into that system be treated humanely and be treated the way you would like your brother or your child to be treated. And yeah, and the second is that the guilty still are punished. Those two demands are often in conflict with one another. And, you know, our decision as a society is that it's better that the guilty go free than the innocent be imprisoned. So there's sort of been a movement backwards, particularly in sentencing, that I don't especially like. I like the way I came of age as a prosecutor with judges having tremendous amount of discretion about what was going to happen to an individual defendant, because everybody who, you know, comes into that system has a different story. So I don't like, you know, mandatory minimums and things like that, because I think they're dehumanizing. They don't treat the individual as an individual. But there are things like DNA that I think has made it a much better process, a process where the innocent are able to go free and the guilty get punished.
It's time for One Big Question with author Scott Turow, author of the new book, Presumed Guilty Beyond the Mic. What's the one problem you see with judicial appointments today, and how do we fix it?
I think it's pretty obvious to everybody what has happened, which is that they are increasingly political. I will tell you that when I was a prosecutor, I never even thought about whether a Republican or a Democrat had appointed the federal judge that I was standing in front of. And that, of course, has changed. Judges come to the bench. They always have come to the bench with political predispositions. But they're a little freer to exercise those views. And that's not a good thing. I do think most judges feel a first loyalty to the law, and that's good. But it also comes these days with a little bit of an expectation of political loyalty, which is just not a good thing for the people who stand in front of them in the courtroom.
He's a weather slut who hates the analysis of literature. Wants you to read his book, Presumed Guilty. The father of the legal thriller, Scott Turow. Thanks, as always, for taking the time to talk with us today.
Sean, it's always good to be with you. Thank you again.
And that, my friends, is Beyond the Mic. If you're enjoying these conversations, please check out another Beyond the Mic episode to find more actors, artists, and people you need to know. We'd also appreciate a like and subscribe on the Good Pods app.